position number 22621, Reel 4.
John Adams, Reel 4.
They formed an extra battery out of the existing three batteries, and it made it more flexible because they had another battery as a spare, you see. They used to do a series of leapfroggings at the business. The infantry used to go in and take a strong point, and we used to consolidate with our anti-tank guns. And then another battalion of infantry would leapfrog it and take another point. But one of the guns, the troop that went from our battery, got mixed up in a tank battle and they suffered pretty heavy casualties. But by that time they were in a different battery, which was named the 326 battery. Ours was the 254. And they had quite a few casualties. But that's the only time I can remember where anybody connected with our battery suffered a lot of casualties. We used to have the odd one. I mean, we used to get sniped at. But we had more casualties actually at casino.
What happened there?
Well, winter was coming on in Italy. We got so far along the Adriatic coast, then it wasn't really tank country, it was a series of rivers and hills and things. So for the winter months, about the end of November, they pulled us out. And they took us to one of the little Italian villages in the south on top of a hill. And what did they call it? I don't remember, I know the name. And we wintered there, you see. And we didn't move again until about March time. Then we moved into the proximity of Casino, and we just stayed there. We hadn't our guns in position at all or anything, because they used to borrow some of our lads to go on patrol with the infantry. They had nothing much to do. And we used to get a bit of long-range shelling, and I remember once there was a mobile film unit came round and put a film on for us. It was a valley, and there had been battles for Casino. I mean, the one we took part in eventually was the fourth battle of Casino. And we watched the Americans bomb the monastery, and, you know, we weren't very far away. We had a sort of a ringside view. They came back in squadrons, I should think, 13 aircraft at a time. They approached from the right, and when they got level with the target, they turned left, and they got right over the monastery and let go the entire cargo, all 13 planes at once. And as they were leaving the scene, I saw another 13 planes come along and did the same thing, and they completely wrecked it. They bombed the town as well of Casino, and they overdid it really, because when they eventually did try to get through it with tanks, it was in such a state of rubble it was impassable.
But you say your unit had casualties at Casino?
Oh yes. I remember when we crossed the ford, it was the Rapido, and when we went across during the winter months, it had been a raging torrent, but in the spring and summer it was dried up to a trickle, but it was still a ford. And there were a couple of bulldozers there filling bomb craters up and shell holes as they occurred. And I remember we were stuck on this crossing for ages. I was getting really anxious. We wanted to get across it as quickly as we could. And I looked away to my left, and I saw a machine gun post, and I thought, what are they doing here? And it was one of ours, one of the British, and all the chaps were in one crouching behind the machine gun, but they never moved. They were all dead. Now, it was just about 50 yards away from where I was. They'd been killed by a blast, I think, and they were frozen in position. And course, we eventually got across and we went into what they call a hide, in a sort of a wood. But then we had to move forward then pretty quickly, and we finished up right at the bottom of Longstop Casino Hill, below the monastery. And we had one anti-tank, the regiment had one anti-tank gun. They were using it more for shelling the Germans with than for anti-tank use. And they used to change the crew every day. And they used to go in under cover of darkness and take another crew out and bring the other one back from the various different batteries. But we had a casualty there. One of the chaps was shot and sniped at, you see. And that's the only one I knew of at that time. And they got a replacement for him, you know, and just within a few weeks he was killed as well. Very unfortunate. Only a young lad, 18. And it was just a case of staying put. I had one or two close shaves there.
Can you tell me about them, please?
Well, there's one night a German aircraft came over dropping flares, and we dug shallow trenches to sleep in, you know, and I was next to a friend of mine who, oh, he said, good, I can see to read my book now with these flares, because they turn night into day virtually. But he was chortling a bit too soon, because the next night they came wind force. I don't know how many planes there were, the Stukas, and they all dropped flares and they started dive bombing, and they're dropping these cluster bombs. And I was down in my trench, you know. I put all my blankets, my greatcoat, my tin hat, my pack, and all the equipment I could find on top of me, you know, for shelter. I didn't raise my head to see if where they were dropping, but I knew they weren't far away. And that went on for, oh, it seemed ages. It maybe wasn't as long as I thought it was. And when I heard the last plane diving and it stopped, I got out, you see, when it cleared up. And I walked over to the main trench. It was a big L-shaped trench where most of the chaps had got down. And I was trying to ask if everybody was all right, you see. But I'd lost my voice. My voice had gone. And when I got to the trench, all the others were the same as well. But I got my voice back presently, you know, pretty quick. And we didn't suffer any casualties at all. But later on, when we first went out to North Africa, I started keeping a diary. I thought it may be coming handy, but an order went round that it was a court-martial offence to keep diaries in case it fell into enemy hands. So I've got the two or three pages still at home which I wrote down, but I discontinued it then. But I think a lot of people must have kept diaries or else to be able to write these books with dates and everything. And yes, one of the 17-pounders, I had to go out to one of the 17-pounders the next day, I think it was, after this raid. And it was quite pretty well far forward, and the day before we'd had some chaps wounded on it and one killed. It came under mortar fire, and one of the chaps lifted his head up to see where they were landing, and a splinter of mortar bomb cut his throat as clean as a whistle, and that was the end of him, and wounded one or two others. And it also took a piece of shrapnel through one of the wheels of the gun, through the tyre. So I had to go round and change the wheel. Now, it shouldn't have been my job to change the wheel. The gun crew should have done it, but I didn't like to say I'm not going, or else I'd have thought I dared. So I went along. I got a lift in the truck. The major gave me a lift and dropped me off. He was going somewhere else. And I had my bag of tools in one hand and pulling the wheel in the other. Well, on the way there, I had to pass the mortar boys. We had the Princess Louise Kensington Regiment. They were a support group. You had 4.2-inch mortars, heavy machine guns and light attack guns. And I was fascinated. There was a great big bloke there and motoring away, and he was dropping mortar bombs in like that and getting another one from one of his mates and dropping one after the other, you know, as quickly as that. And when I see it on television now, when it shows you people motoring, they put one in and then they go like that. I thought our chaps weren't doing that at casino. And this chappy must have had about 6 mortar bombs in the air at any one time. And the ground was a bit soft there, strangely enough. And the mortar had sunk into the ground. Oh, only had about 4 inches above the ground. He was still dropping mortar bombs in.
You mean he wasn't covering his ears up?
Oh, no, no. He was stripped to the waist and he was dropping mortar bombs in, you know, like nobody's business. Anyhow, I thought I'd better get on, so I went to the troop headquarters and asked them where the gun was. It was down a track under a tree. So I wheeled the wheel down, and the gun tower, the quad, they used to call the gun towers, it was parked in an olive grove or something at the opposite side of the track. So I went across to get the jack out and any bits of wood I could to jack it up on, and I got cracking and loosened the wheel and got the jack under it and started jacking up. But as I jacked it up, the ground was so soft, it was farmland, the jack was sinking into the ground, so I thought I'd better go and get some help. So I went back to the troop, they were all lined up sitting on the bank, and they were all what we used to call bomb happy, because they weren't saying anything, they were just staring straight in front, and I was going like that to see if they could see me. No.
Waving your hand in front of their eyes.
Pardon?
Waving your hand in front of their eyes.
Yes, yes. And I couldn't get anybody to come and give me a hand, because I wanted somebody to jack the gun up like mad so that I could get the wheel off and put the other one on before it sunk into the ground. And I couldn't persuade anybody to come with me, but in the end I appealed to one chap who I knew was from Yorkshire. I said, "Where's your Yorkshire grit? Come on, give us a hand, you know." So he came. Well, we just got cracking when a couple of shots rang out from further down the track. And he yelled, "Sniper," and he's off down the track like a hare. So I drew me a revolver and jumped over the trail of the gun and got right under it so that I could just see under the shield to see where it was coming from. But I couldn't see anything. And I waited there a while. And then I just got up and walked back to a troop headquarters. But I've often wondered since. I didn't know whether there was a round in the gun, because if there had been, I'd have pointed the gun at a tree and let rip with it. But anyhow, when I got back to troop headquarters, the battery captain was there on the radio. He said, "Don't bother trying anymore." He said, "Just wait, the attack's going on in a minute, and they'll be too busy then to bother with you." So I just waited about a quarter of an hour, and then I went back and changed the wheel. And there were the sort of experiences I got. Incidentally, when I was going back, the Germans opened fire on one of our troops on the track on the way back. It was all lined up to go forward. And I followed the track right round to battery headquarters. But I didn't know at the time, if I'd just gone as far as this troop and then turned right and walked over the hill, I'd have got there a lot more quickly. I didn't know it doubled that. And anyhow, I hadn't been back 10 minutes when all hell broke loose. And I looked over this hillock and there's bits of truck and guns and all sorts flying up into the air. Then I said to one of my pals, I said, "That's B troop getting it." I said, "They're just over there." And when it all stopped, B troop, led by their officer, they just come marching over the top of the hill. It's like one of these films you see where you see one of these westerns where the Indians are coming and you see them coming over the hilltop, of just the tops of the end of the hill until they get up, just like that. And the officer was going, "Oh," he said, "I've lost all my trucks and all my guns." He said, "I won't have to go into action now."
Unit was he from?
Pardon?
Which unit was he from?
Our unit, our battery. And the major overheard him. He called for him later. Mr. Smith, you can go out on a recce. So I had to go out on a recce on foot, and he was missing for 2 days. Then they found him down a trench with a dead German, didn't get out.
Did he tell you about it?
No, he didn't, no. The other lads did. I had another job to do as well. He came with me, this officer. There was a 17-pounder stuck in a olive grove or a wood or something, and he had to go and retrieve it. They couldn't get it out. So I got the driver, and we went down. He came with me. And I soon spotted the gun. Mm. Yeah, it was just on the other side of a quite deep ditch, and there was a track leading down, so I told the driver to take the track and go down and see what the position was. Now, it was deeper trench than ditch than it looked from the top, and this officer was also coming back. He said, oh, he said, we can't get that out, we'll have to leave it for the LAD or somebody. So I said, no, we're going to get it out. I've come down here to get it out. So I got the driver to turn round and back down to the track until the back end of the truck was over the ditch. Then we got over the ditch and we manhandled the gun across the ditch until it was just just able to do it without the wheel slipping down. And we hooked it on. Then we all got back in the truck and I told the driver, I said, put it in four-wheel drive, bottom gear, let out the clutch and put your foot down, which he did. And it just manhandled the gun right across the ditch. It dropped in and it come out again, so we got it back. And I was pleased about that because otherwise I'd have gone round the other way and found another way to it if I'd been able to. But I said to the driver, keep to the same tracks as you came along in, because I said, you never know, it might be mined. You say, you don't have to run over a mine. And we got it back. Then, about the same time, one evening, we were all standing about talking, and the major said, oh, he said, it's coming in a bit cold, isn't it? So one of the other side said, oh, he said, they'll lend him a jacket, sir. He had his jacket on with his stripes on and everything. The major was pleased to borrow it. Well, just then, a Danar came along, a dispatch rider. And he was looking for Major Weldon, so they asked us, where can we find Major Weldon? So we just said, that's Major Weldon there. And he wouldn't believe us. We all had a right good laugh. He didn't have to take some persuading. Because he didn't expect to see a major with three stripes on. That was the best part of army life. You could always get a laugh at something. But the next day, I think it was, when one of the troops moved forward and the Germans were shelling with a long-range gun, and they'd got down this sort of dugout place, and it was a German defence position, but it was facing the wrong way. Now, one of these shells hit it, and it killed about five of them. There's one chap who'd given me a lift up that very morning. I got in his truck and he was just having a cup of tea before he set off, and enamel mugs we had. He said, you want a drink? No, I said, you drink it. I don't know when you'll get another. I'll get one when I get back to battery headquarters. So I was quite pleased about that because he was cut in two with the shell. And they were digging away with the bare hands to get the others out. They got some out alive, but there was three or four that couldn't, suffocated. Buried alive, you know.
And this was your battery? This was your battery?
Our battery, yes, yes. So it seemed as if we'd been engaged in any action or anything, you know, when you hit by a shell. Another time, around about the same time, we'd been sitting down in this, it was a scene, you'd think it was almost from the First World War. There was this wood and there wasn't a single tree standing, they were all stumps. And we were getting something to eat, it was lunchtime or dinner time or whatever. And there's some fighting going on to the right. I don't know what it was. There was machine gun fire and all sorts of things. Then all at once I could hear these bullets zipping through the air. That's the sort of sound they make. So I moved round the ball of this tree so that my back, it was between me and the direction the firing's coming from. And there was the sanitary man, he was eating his dinner just near me, and he was backed up against a tree stump. I said, "Hey, Bunny," his name was Austin, so we used to call him Bunny after the famous tennis player, "get round that tree or else," I said, "you'll be stopping one." He said, "Bugger the Germans, I'm having my dinner." So he just stayed put. But apparently a German regiment had been trying to fight its way through. And an infantry company, I think it was Royal West Kents or East Surrey or something, they were in our division. They'd fought them back, pushed them back. I think that's about all I can really remember about Casino, except that it was our it went on until I don't know who got the credit. The Poles went up the monastery hill and took the monastery, but they couldn't have done that until the route, the supply route, had been cut, Route 6. And so far as I know, it was our division that cut Route 6 and stopped the supplies getting up, because, I mean, when the units in action, the armies are in action, they've got to have a constant supply of ammunition and stuff. And once the supplies cut off, they just can't do anything.
So after Casino, did you have a rest or did you continue?
Not immediately. We continued. Went up, continued our journey up the east coast, but it was only a few weeks, I think. They moved us back in the end, but I had another fairly exciting episode. I don't know exactly where it was somewhere along the east coast, and again, I was having my midday meal, and there was nobody else there. There was the two trucks, two motorbikes, and I don't know where all the chaps were. There was nobody there but me. I was sitting on a chair or something, eating with my mess tin, you know, and there was a two-stroke motor, charger, battery charger, which the wireless blokes used to charge the batteries up with. And I couldn't hear anything, and all of a sudden I heard this noise, and I looked up, and there's two Fokker Wolfs diving out of the sun, and they're coming straight at me, apparently, you know. Ooh. Then the first one dropped a bomb, almost immediately the other one dropped a bomb, and they both exploded, just across the road from me, which was no further than it is across the road from here. And then they whizzed out again, and back out to sea. The Germans used to come in low over the sea, and you couldn't hear them. Then they'd do a quick turn, pick a target, bomb it, or shoot it up or something, and scarper off again. But a great big piece of shell, a bomb splinter, dropped near me. Must have weighed at least a couple of stone, and it was just alongside me. And I put my hand down, and it was quite hot. And I thought, if that had been a foot over this way, it hit me on the end, that would have been my loss.
What do you think had attracted them?
Why, our trucks, I should think. There's two trucks and motorbikes. I rather fancy that, well, they're opportunists, the Germans. They weren't as calm as our airmen, I don't think, because we used to watch at Casino. In North Africa as well, the Hurricanes, they used to use them as fighter bombers, but they'd have a bomb under each wing, they'd dive down and drop a bomb, and then they'd climb up again and come down and drop another bomb. And then when they dropped the bomb, they'd shoot everything up, you see. Then they'd come back over our lines, and they had the canopies open, they'd be waving to us like that, you know. But the Germans never did that. It was all hit and run real fast.
Why do you think there was the difference?
Well, I think the Germans had got rid of them. They'd lost all the best pilots, I should think. I think there'd be young pilots barely trained. But I noticed that I was...
You said before Casino you had that winter of 43-44 up on the mountain top.
Yeah.
What exactly happened to you then?
Well, we got snowed in for starts. Yes, it was from there. I went on leave. I had a week's leave. Two of us. I went with the MT sergeant, and we couldn't get back for the snow. We had to come back across country, and there's great deep snow drifts. It's surprising how cold it can be in Italy in winter. And when we got back, all the lads were digging the snow drifts out. And of course the village was full of Italians, and none of them would help. They were lazy lots. All the men used to stand about outside the church all day. But I will say they helped us with food because we couldn't get any supplies through. And they had plenty of food, I don't know where they got it from.
Can you tell me now about the push northwards beyond Casino, please?
Yes, well, that's nearly as far. I've just described, that episode about the bombs. And we didn't go much further than that because we soon got a message that they were pulling us out. And we were going to Egypt. We were supposed to be finished with the war. We were supposed to be going to Palestine eventually to police the place, you know. But we pulled out. We went to Rome by road. Coming back on the way through Casino, we stopped there briefly and I didn't know anything about it. I mean, we'd been having a drink, you know, and we were just a little bit. And somebody said to me, that shell went off not far from you, didn't it? I didn't hear any shell. It was an unexploded shell exploded. So anyhow, we made our way back to Rome, and we handed all our trucks and guns and motorbikes, everything except our weapons, over to another division. And then we continued part of the journey by train until we got within marching distance of Taranto, because that's where we set sail for Egypt. And we did a 15-mile march, you know, and it was quite a feat, really, because we had all our equipment on, and I had a revolver, a 38 revolver, and a Thompson submachine gun. And marching along, we all had to take a spell at carrying a Bren gun as well. Well, there were a few Bren guns, and we were supposed to carry a Bren gun for about 10 minutes on this march, and then hand it to the chap behind you, that's next to you. But, I mean, it got to such a pitch that you'd hand one Bren gun over, and almost immediately you'd get another one, which meant that somebody up front wasn't carrying it as far as they should have done. Anyhow, we got there, and of course we had to catch some sort of transport to the actual docks, but we went to Egypt in one of these Liberty ships. There's a programme on television not long ago about them, you know, the way the American mass produced them. And of course we went to Port Said. That's the gateway to the canal, isn't it?
Yes.
And, you know, the ship was followed by dolphins like they always are. And when we got to Port Said, there's all these Egyptians, Arabs, coming out trying to flog us stuff out of boats, you know. And all the lads, and they're throwing rubbish at them. And we went to a camp near Cairo, actually. Katara camp, and it was quite good there, but I got food poisoning.
How did that happen?
Well, I went into, there was a sort of a church army canteen or a naffy place or something, and I mean, really, the army food was, well, it's tolerable, you could eat it when you had to do, but the Navy and the Air Force were much better fed than we were. They had, you know, they had their own chefs and bakers, and they never had to eat hard tack, like hard biscuits like we did, and tins of bully and all that. They had proper meals in their messes. And we went into this canteen and had a feed of egg, bacon, tomatoes, you know. Well, the next day we had to go on a shoot. That meant we took the guns onto a range to get a bit of firing practice on. And I didn't feel too bad at the time, but all of a sudden I collapsed. So they loaded me up on the truck and they took me back to the camp and they put me on the camp bed in the tent and I lay there for 3 days and never moved.
Where was this?
In Egypt, Qatar camp, spelt with a Q.